Hi, I'm Dr. Jean Kanakogi. I'm 54 years old. Today is December 29th, 2020. I'm located in New Jersey, and I'm here speaking with Angie Delgado and Marty Malloy. I'm not an Olympian, but I was a member of the U.S. Judo team.
Hi, I am Marty Malloy. I'm 34. It is December 29th, 2020. I am in San Jose, California, talking with Jean and Angie. I know them both from judo, and I am a judoka. I competed in the 2012 and 2016 Olympic Games, took a bronze medal in 2012, also a world silver medalist.
Hello, I'm Angelica Delgado. I am as of 2 weeks ago, 30 years old. Today is the 29th of December, 2020. I am currently in Coral Springs, Florida, close to Miami. I'm speaking with Jean and Marty, from which I know from judo. I am a 2016 Olympian and a 2020 Olympic hopeful, well, 2021 now. And I've also participated in 9 world championships.
Wow, this is fantastic. It's a very unique situation to be in because we have the past. We have the history of my mother, Rusty Kanakogi, that fought to get women's judo in the Olympics. We have a past Olympic medalist, and we have the 2021 hopeful on the same call. So this is really just amazing experience. And I'm very curious, how did you guys get into judo?
Angie, you go first.
Well, I began doing judo because my father was on the national team for Cuba. So he began doing judo in Cuba. And when he defected to the United States, I'm the firstborn child of my family. So he taught me judo as well in the backyard of our house. And that's kind of how I began my judo journey when I was 9 years old.
I've seen that backyard. Wait, wasn't there a tree back there that you were like, my dad made me do uchikomis on this tree or something? Or uchikomis being like work doing judo moves on a tree. Am I misremembering that?
We haven't we had it unfortunately it died, but we had an avocado tree. We had an avocado tree in our backyard, and he tied a rope to like the top, and he would make me like climb rope. I couldn't really reach the top when I was that young, but he would make me like at least try, just do a couple more each day, climbing a rope all the way to the top, and then we would do like uchikomi, and he would teach me certain techniques and stuff like that in our backyard. So.
That's awesome. I love your dad. So I started judo, I guess similarly related somehow to my dad, even though my mom is the one who put us in judo because my dad was in the Navy and they offer free like fitness classes and recreational areas to Navy dependents. And judo just happened to be a free class on the Navy base. And so I have three brothers. My mom was technically a one parent household when my dad would get deployed for the Navy for 6 months to a year at a time. So she put me and my brothers in it, and that the rest is kind of history. Jean, what about you?
Well, I was practically born on the mat. My mother, Rusty Kanakogi, was teaching judo, and she was pregnant with me at the time. One of her students was also her gynecologist, her OBGYN, and she was teaching. And next thing you know, I was ready. I wanted to come into this world, and they went to the hospital. And while she was waiting in labor, they were going over his kata because he was going for a shodan. So in between contractions, she was going over his kata technique. So that really is a story of being born on the mat. And growing up in the shadow of the mother of women's judo, I've been referred to as the daughter of women's judo because of all the history. And just as a segue, I'll take a little bit of time and let you guys know that women's judo was not where it is today. And in 1959, when Rusty wanted to compete, she had no choice, but she had to disguise herself as a man. She was put into a competition, used an ace bandage to tape down her chest. She changed in a broom closet, And she was put in the competition, a team competition, so that she, and she was told just to get a draw, don't pull any attention to yourself. But what did she do? Her team was cheering for her, and she thought, well, I fought this hard and I trained this hard. Why can't I win? I deserve to win. She threw her male opponent for an ippon, which is a full point in judo, and or a perfect score that everybody strives to get. Well, then her team won the first place trophy, and it was just so big in 1959 to win that way. But she was pulled aside and she was told, hey, are you a girl? They wouldn't even give her the respect of calling her a woman. That's how condescending and misogynistic it was back then. And they took her medal away and said, well, if you don't forfeit this, your team's going to have to lose. And that was the time, that pivotal moment actually affects both of your lives, because she decided that that's never going to happen to another woman, and that not on her watch. And that's how it all started. So I grew up in the shadows of that, and I was always pushed one step harder, because women did have to fight harder to get the recognition. And same thing, both of you, I'm sure, experience, and that's going to be my question. Do you find that you have to fight harder to get the recognition and to get the respect than your male counterparts?
Marty? Go ahead, Marty.
I made you answer first last time, Angie. I don't feel that personally. I think we've come a long way from the story that you just told, to be honest. Or maybe there's just become an understanding in the judo world that, like, we all need the opportunity to, you know, win tournaments and have access to training facilities and have our own divisions at a tournament. Like, it's been so long since we had to fight to have that basic right. And to be honest, just hearing you talk about what Rusty went through, it's like, I cannot imagine a time when things were that set up against women in a way where they couldn't just participate in equal capacity. Like, it's hard to even but that's an agreement. I mean, what do you think, Angie? I try to think of ways now that Is that your dog, Angie? I'm
babysitting three dogs.
Oh my gosh.
All right, go ahead.
It's okay. No, I mean, I was trying to think of a way that I feel that I have less access, or did before I retired. Like, do you feel that there's ways that women don't have access in judo the way men do?
We definitely have the same, especially I would say competitively, we have the same access and the same support as men do now. It's just, I think some male competitors, I would say, I've seen it a little bit more. Maybe it's because the culture that we're around, like some of our fellow male competitors might still say, oh, it's this division of women's judo. It's not as competitive as, like, let's say the men's 73 kilogram division, or like other male divisions that have like 100 competitors at world championships or so on and so forth. So that makes it harder for men. You don't have to compete against so many other women or whatever. So they try to make that comparison to kind of, you know, undermine you. I've also had some people, I've done clinics before, and I've had some people say, like, oh, well, do you have a guy that can teach me this, or can teach my son, because I'm not qualified to teach other girls or stuff like that. So I've had those instances, definitely. But I definitely see that we do have a lot more opportunity. And when I go to places like Japan or France or any of these other countries to train or compete, there's definitely just as many women on the mat as there are men. So I don't see a difference there at all anymore.
You know, and hearing that you guys don't see that much of a drastic difference, is it really gives Rusty another gold medal, you know, and because every step of the way, every inch, every just to get into the National Sports Festival or the Olympic Sports Festival, to get into the Pan American Games, to get availability and access to live and train at the Olympic Training Center in Colorado Springs was a lawsuit, was a fight. And there was so many lies and so much deceit. Yeah, you know, judo can be very political. And back then, a lot of the men, a lot of the naysayers did not want women to compete in judo. Do you have any idea, or have you ever thought in retrospect, why men were so against women competing in judo? And then I'll share with you some of the reasons they've told Rusty.
I mean, I guess that it's not a judo thing. It's a understanding that women and men should have equal opportunity to do things. And so I guess judo was just one example of a way they were just trying to adhere to an old way of thinking. And I'm sure it extends to everything. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, you said back in 1959, she wasn't allowed to compete at all. I mean, just look at the time period, you know, 50s, the 60s. I mean, they probably thought women should only be in the kitchen and taking care of children and for procreating. And that's about it, you know. So.
That's true. Matter of fact, in 1980, she found out for women's judo, or before 1980, she found out in order to get women to be considered as an Olympic sport in judo, they had to have a world championship. And there was no world championship at that time. So she wanted to hold the first women's world judo championships. And she only had about $150 in the bank, but she was determined. And she, I don't know where she came up with this idea, but off the top of her head, she said, we're going to do it in New York and we're going to hold it at Madison Square Garden. And it's going to be the biggest event. And of course, everybody, the reality checkers told her, Rusty, we have no money. She went into the dojo and she told everybody at the dojo, myself included, we're holding a world championships. And she did 127 competitors, 25 or 26 countries. And it was absolute chaos. It was pandemonium, but that started it all. And that started the road to judo becoming an Olympic sport. So as you can imagine, she had to overcome so much adversity, and judo was part of that. How do you guys feel about what obstacles have stood in your way, and how did you overcome levels of adversity that you were faced with?
I knew you were gonna make. Definitely something that I've had to overcome throughout the years. When I started judo, it's funny because I recently just watched the live action Mulan, and your mother's story kind of reminds me of that, you know, like Ace bandaging her chest to be able to compete, and all that. She's like the real life, like judo Mulan. But my dad, we were watching it together with my father, and my dad was like, oh, you're my Mulan, because I had so many people telling me that you should do ballet, you should play piano and like do things that were typical for women. And he refused any of those old like Hispanic stereotypes, you know, that they come up so often, like I should be proper and I shouldn't be fighting with other boys and so on and so forth. He's like, no, she can do whatever she wants. And I also had to fight not just the stereotypes, but I wasn't always the most athletic kid growing up. You know, I was kind of chubby. I was a little bit overweight. Marty can attest to this. Up until I was about 13, 14 years old, I actually fought in the 63 kilogram women's division. So I actually fight two weight classes below that now. Yeah, I compete in 52 kilograms. So that's something that, I mean, I don't know if it's fighting genetics or what it is. It's definitely part of the discipline and part of the sacrifice. I say it's the price I have to pay in order to do what I love and in order to compete and bring back an Olympic medal. So those are things that, you know, you sacrifice every day in the name of judo and of doing what I love every single day.
But it's amazing to hear you say that in juxtaposition to Rusty, because it's like, now all you have to think about is being the best athlete. Like, that's it. I'm not saying that's like easy, but like yeah. You used to, like, you get to just show up at the tournament and know that you got your weight right and you trained hard and like coming from a time when like I just want to compete, like just let me compete. It's so crazy to like hear those two stories like next to each other, that time frame in between them, you know.
Yeah, now there's actually a place for me, so I don't have to worry about, you know, exactly.
There's a place for you. And I guess that's I feel like that's a hard question, Jean, because we come from a time where it's like, what other opportunities are presenting themselves now that we've opened this Pandora's box, right? And I mean, I think you can look at the, for judo specifically, for women in the US, like Kayla and I had a great Olympics in 2012. And then the very next Olympics, we have another female join the team. And now she's going to be our, like the, pretty much the guaranteed Angie, like going to be on the Olympic team next year with a year to go, a little more, less than a year. I mean, that's amazing. Look how far we've come.
That is amazing. And I love hearing these stories. You know, like we were talking about before, I recently wrote Rusty's memoir, and it's called Get Up and Fight. And Marty highlighted that even though it's called Get Up and Fight, it's not really related to only on the mat. That's mm-hmm. through life. I heard that so many times in life from Rusty. And some of the things that are highlighted, you know, the overarching message, it's not just a judo book. It's about being relentless, following through, inspiring others, inspiring yourself. It's about diversity. It's about inclusion. And it really is a book to empower. So those are all some very powerful words. What do you identify with out of those powerful words? And how have you gotten up and fought?
Mm.
Angie? Marty?
I mean, the thing that resonates with me the most of all those power words you just dropped is the relentless part. And we were talking about this a little earlier. We haven't mentioned it right now, is your involvement, Jean, around 9/11 and, you know, feeling like this is really hard and how to keep going and that relentless judo spirit that you feel. And I think that that's kind of what Rusty like represents and kind of what we all think about when we, or at least I don't want to speak for everyone, when I think of Rusty, this like in acceptance to take anything other than the opportunities that we deserve and just fighting and fighting until you get them. And I think that that it's definitely a judo mentality. Angie to me definitely exemplifies that as well. Like she's got this fighting spirit and like this pride and unwillingness to give up that just pushes her to the limit all the time. And yeah, I mean, that's definitely something that I don't know if you learn from judo or you have, and so you do judo.
I mean, I can't really, I don't know if you learn that from judo. I think it's something that if you want it bad enough or you're passionate enough, you acquire it over time and you kind of don't take no for an answer, you know? Marty, you were with me for so many years. I think I met you probably when I was 14 or 15 years old. So you've seen like me over the years and the progression and stuff. And definitely for me, the hardest part of my career was not making the team in 2012, was going as your training partner. But that was also kind of like a moment where I was like, I want this no matter what. So I, you know, reevaluated everything I was doing, my training, my diet. I went to go see a sports psychologist. You know, I didn't take no for an answer. Like your mother, like so many other, you know, female judokas since her. And then I did all the things right I needed to do in order to make the team in 2016. Mm-hmm. Now I'm doing all the things I need to do in order to get an Olympic medal next year. So it's not, you know, judo, one of the beauties of judo itself is that, I mean, you're not going to get a black belt overnight or in a year, in 2 years. My coach always says it's a lifetime sport because it takes so long to get better. And you have to be relentless in order to see the progression and to see the change. But later you look back and it's, you know, it's a lifetime thing. It's mm-hmm. so,
you know, that's a great segue, because when I used to train, and Rusty being my mother, coach, mentor, and everything under the sun, she always used to tell me to be hungry. And I'm thinking to myself, I fought in the over 72 kilo category. I was never hungry. Be hungry. You have to be hungry to win. You have to have that deep down grit and that determination. And she used to tell me it'll carry over into life. So earlier I mentioned I'm a federal agent. I'm a current active agent. And going through the academy, there was a lot to go through. And I reached deep down into that grit and determination to get through some of the exercises, to get through some of the events that I had to get through in order to graduate. And that's how judo transferred over into my life. So where do you guys have that hunger and that grit hidden when you have to reach into it? And when have you reached into it?
It's such a good question, because it really is like you do reach down right somewhere. And I think for me, I'm just going to jump in here. It's like I learned early on, and I don't know how or when, that the harder you work and just commit to doing the best you can, whatever that task is, what you just have to give it 1,000% for that time frame that you're doing it. And you need to do it the best optimal way. And whether that's doing push-ups before judo practice, which we always did. I wanted to make sure I could do all 100 of them. And it's really young age that I was thinking this way. And I see now, looking back as a 34-year-old adult, that kind of discipline is kind of what has propelled me throughout my entire life in every single thing I do. And I don't know why it's so important, but it's basically a belief that you can keep going long after you consciously think you cannot. And I think the really good players and the ones that excel far understand that. I know Angie understands it, because I've seen you go through things that are just so hard and just put your mind to it and complete it and get through it to because you're going to do it. We're going to get it done, you know? And I think that's kind of it. That's the way I think of grit, at least. I know I didn't answer your question directly, but like, that's kind of the way I've done it and found success. And it's helped me outside judo too.
Definitely. Just to keep on with that train of thought. I mean, there are certain, for example, with school, I'm currently finishing my bachelor's, and I hadn't gone to school in about 2.5 years, and I was a little bit nervous in the beginning. And then I was like, man, if I've been able to do all of these things and accomplish all of these things throughout judo in my career, I'm like, school's gonna be a breeze. I'm like, it'll be fine, you know. Because it's that fear of the unknown. So I was like, you'll be fine. You'll do great at whatever you do. And as long as, like Marty said, you give it 100% and you give it your all, you're gonna do amazing. And I ended up getting straight A's this semester. So, you know, I know, I was so excited.
You're so smart.
So I was like, you know what, as long as I give the same attitude and the same commitment that I do in judo, the same discipline, I'll be successful at whatever I do.
You were taking all those classes while you've been traveling and competing this whole season?
Yes, but because of COVID, I mean, we haven't really traveled that much.
Yeah. No, I know. But still, you kept a full...
I was full-time.
Where are you? What university? Remind me.
Florida International University.
That's awesome. I'm proud of you.
That's very proud of you. I am a huge proponent of education. So congratulations. You know, Angie, you said something about the fear of unknown. And, you know, back after Rusty got her medal taken away and she wanted to know more about judo, she ventured to this far off land called Japan. So could you imagine 1960, a female going to Japan? And I mean, the antics that happened when she was over there, and she didn't speak the language. So she went to go train at the Kodokan, and she was put in the women's section, which was only doing kata. So she met up with Miss Fukuda, and she got really good kata basics, but she wanted more. She was hungry. She wanted to compete on the men's side of the dojo, and she wanted to learn that combat judo. Well, finally, she got her wish, and she really embodied fall down 7 times, get up 8, because that was her daily routine. And then people didn't know what to make of her. I mean, she was this 5'10" redhead from New York, and nobody knew what to make of her. Even my my dad, who was one of the high level competitors there, was looking at her from around the corner. He had no idea what to expect. So, I mean, a lot of the fear of the unknown, but she did go to Japan. She did gain the respect of, and she actually tested for her Nidan in front of Risei Kano, Jigoro Kano's son, and got her Nidan granted from him. So, I mean, this was a lot of the fear of the unknown. And I know as an athlete, there's so much of the unknown. You know, Rusty experienced hers, but there's so much of the unknown. And sometimes people don't talk too much about the fear of winning, because that puts you in a whole different category. Marty, you've got a bronze medal. Before the bronze medal, you didn't have a bronze medal. So the fear of the unknown, now what? Now what lies ahead? How much pressure, and how do you cope with that pressure of winning and the fear of the unknown of after you win?
I mean, I think the fear part comes from, like, what is that saying? You know, our greatest fear is not that we are inadequate. It's that we're powerful beyond measure. And it's like when you really think about that, you're like, no, of course I want to win. Why would I be afraid to be powerful? But in reality, at the real core of it, it's like, once you do that thing, like, what's next? That question. The idea that could hold you back from achieving what you're capable of is kind of crazy, but I do think that it happens a lot more than people realize. It's kind of why they say, like, it's all mental, it's a mental game, it's 99%. That's 100% true. That's that same quote at play in my mind. And I think that that's something that affected me a lot during my career, definitely in the last Olympics, 2016, before I retired. Looking back in hindsight, I see it. Then I couldn't see it then. I think I was even in denial a little bit about how I was feeling, that because I had taken a bronze in 2012, that I needed to medal again, or the bronze no longer had as much power to it or something. There's some mentality around that I didn't personally choose to look at. I chose to say, no, you got this, you got this, you got this. And then it's kind of afterwards that you really see that maybe your frame of mind wasn't in the right place to have an optimal performance. I'd be curious, Angie, what you think, given that you still have that Olympics ahead of you in the next year.
I mean, for me, it's a little bit different. It's taken me some time. Marty, I remember you when, like, you were always someone that I looked up to. For me, you were team captain. I remember going to my first Juvenile Pan American Championship, and Marty was the only one on the team that won gold. He was the only one that beat Brazil in the final. So for me, that was, and at that time we were in the same weight class, but she was a couple years older than me, but he was always somebody that I looked to, and that had so much more success than I did, and I thought, you know. So I definitely, over the years, I've had to kind of conquer that fear of winning, like you mentioned, Gene. Am I enough? Am I enough to win? Mm-hmm. You know, like I said, I wasn't always the most athletic. So I've had to work for every single thing that I've ever gotten in my career. So when I finally got there, I'm like, do I have enough, or do I need a little bit more? Do I need to perfect this technique? Maybe if I do this, it'll make me better. And I had to sit down and reevaluate and reassess and say, no, with everything that I have, everything that I am, I'm enough to win today. And kind of all that matters.
It's a belief, exactly. Right?
It is. And it's a mental game. What I wanted to ask you is, you know, mentally, when I used to compete, Rusty used to always have me visualize the follow through, visualize doing the technique and following completely through all the way to the ground, into the ippon, into the win. How do you guys prepare mentally? Because there's so many things going on outside. Physically, we all know how you prepare. You work your tails off and you prepare. But how do you prepare mentally for the fights?
Visualization, like you said, is definitely something that helps. It helps a lot to kind of visualize, let's say, the Paris Grand Slam. Every year we know that it's at the Bercy Stadium, and we picture the stadium, and I picture myself warming up and what gi I'm going to wear and kind of what the draw is going to look like, because you never really know. And you just go through the entire day up until you're on top of the podium, you know, fight by fight, opponent by opponent. You know, you tell yourself, oh, I'm going to go up against the French girl, and she's a righty, so I'm going to grab the sleeve and I'm going to do this. Sometimes it doesn't work out that way, but you know, the more you go through that in your mind, I feel like the more I am prepared for that moment of when I get out in the get out of the shoot. And the Bercy Stadium, I mean, it's just enormous. It's a soccer stadium and it's full of fans, and it's a beautiful experience. But when I first competed at Paris Grand Slam, I was about 18 years old, and it was like this surreal moment, you know, for all these competitors. So now, more than 10 years later, 12 years later, I'm definitely more used to that, you know, and experience and stuff. So visualization is definitely something that helps.
I think it's like, it's preparing you for like the scenario you're going to be in. Like I'll never forget when I made it to the final of the Worlds in 2013. I had kind of like been in the zone all day. And then before the final,
Yeah, you were.
I was in the zone. And then I lost in the final though. And to the build up to the final, there was a moment when I kind of came into the present moment and kind of looked around and realized that my lifelong dream of being in a world championship final was happening right now. Like it's happening. You're in it right now. And I walked out into a stadium very similar to the scenario Angie just described in Paris, but in Brazil instead. So a little less proper, maybe a little more like drums and hooting, tooting horns, and everyone screaming the name of the girl, the local girl I was about to fight. And I just remember being completely jarred by the moment. And that's not an excuse of why I lost, but that visualization that Angie talks about putting yourself in the moment before the moment is there, is like, there's no substitute for it, because there can literally be a scenario where you go, wait a minute, oh my gosh, like the reality of the moment you're living through right now can throw you off, which is scary almost in that moment. You don't perform, you're suboptimal if that happens to you. But the visualization, you know, puts you ahead of it as much as it can, I guess.
You know, that spills over, I mean, to my day job, being in law enforcement.
Oh, I bet.
I visualize a good outcome. And I remember once I was following a suspect, and I was going down into a dark basement. And my first thought was, wow, somebody should call the police. This is scary. And then I realized, oh, gosh, that's me. Mm-hmm. So, you know, and growing up, I had to be in the shadow of Rusty. So the pressure of being a Kanakogi was tremendous. And there were mantras that our parents would give us, like, Angie, you know, your father from Cuba, and he had to overcome, I'm sure, a ton. Marty, your dad being in the Navy, I'm sure he had challenges. But they also create their own mantras, their own sayings that kind of stay in your head from when you're a kid and to keep you going. Rusty used to tell me, in life, you can either be the hammer or the nail. You will be the hammer.
Good one.
So, choose to be the hammer. And that was what I grew up with. I grew up being, you know, having to be the hammer because I didn't want to be the nail. Marty, what did your dad, especially a Navy man, what did he say to you?
You know what? He wasn't the type to have mantras or little sayings. He would, I think he was more of a lead by example type. Like, so hardworking. Like, I'll never forget. It's so funny. I would brag to my friends, my dad has 3 jobs, when they were like, oh, okay. And I was like, so like, he's a scuba diver, he's a mechanic, and he's in the Navy. And I was like bragging, but I didn't realize, now as an adult, I realized like he would needed money. We didn't have a lot of money. And so I just grew up with that mentality of like, you find ways to make it work. You always do your best. My dad's definitely the busy type. So he was always kind of going after something and keeping himself busy, but always working really, really hard. He's a reliable guy. And I think that's what I took away from it the most. Same with my mom, you know, just raising four kids a lot of the time on her own, in a state away from where she wasn't born. Like, they find ways to make it work, and it gets tough, and they find a way through it. And I saw that always my whole life. Angie, I'm sure your dad has some great saying, because he's so good at that stuff. Motivational, he is.
My dad is a talker, definitely. He would give me speeches all the time. But honestly, it's mostly, we grew up in a very religious household. So it's mostly, you know, Bible quotes and scripture and stuff like that. That, you know, he would compare us to the Israelites and, you know, suffering and all this stuff. So it's a lot of that. But yeah, my dad, he really, the best example that I could give is that my dad is definitely a dreamer, and he never killed my dream. You know, I sat down with him when I was 9 years old, around 8 or 9 years old, and he would put old judo videos of like the world championships or Paris Grand Slam used to be Tournoi de Paris back, you know, before all these slams and Grand Prix and stuff. And I would just sit there and I would say, I want to be Olympic champion and I want to be world champion. And he would tell me, yes, you can do it. You can do anything. Mm-hmm. You can do anything you want. And he never ever killed my dream. Even now, you know, calling me his Mulan, and I'm 30 years old, you know, like he's always been that way. And he's like, why don't you, you know, you should be a medical doctor, and you should be a doctor, and you could be an Olympic medalist. Like, you could do anything. So my dad's always been that way.
He's right.
He is.
He's so passionate. I love it. Angie, make sure you tell him I said hi next time you talk to him. And Jean, I want to ask you a question before we run out of time. I'm curious, growing up in your household with Rusty, and you've mentioned a couple times, like, she's a little bit larger than life and it's a little bit of a shadow. What was it like, if you're comfortable sharing this, in your family? Like, was it always go, go, go? Was she always working toward making a change? Or what was that like growing up for you?
Our dining room table was covered in papers. Everything, every judo document that you can imagine, the weigh-in sheets from wherever, the audio recording. She used to walk around with a tape recorder and at every international event and record who did what technique on whom, write the coaches' reports, and she would keep a record of everybody. So when you were ready to fight somebody, she would know what their technique was, if they were righty, lefty, if they were if they came in for a leg sweep or if they came in for a hip throw, she would know. So it was constantly go, go, go. As a teenager, I was hardly ever allowed to use the telephone, because that long telephone cord in our kitchen was used to call the International Olympic Committee, the American Civil Liberties Union, to call and yell at somebody. It was judo 24/7.
Wow.
At one point, she was on the phone with, and I remember overhearing the conversation, she called and she needed to speak to Lord Killeen from the International Olympic Committee as she was fighting to get women's judo included into the Olympics. And she yelled, everybody shut up, I'm talking to the Lord. So, and you probably, Angie, heard that in your household too. Yeah. But she actually was. So growing up, it was nonstop. I ate, slept, and drank judo. If I wanted to see my parents, I'd have to be at the dojo.
Were you okay with that?
I was, because my judo family was also extended. I grew up with, you know, brothers and sisters from all over the world, and we're still friends. You know, and I learned different languages because our dojo was so eclectic. Everybody from the kids from the private schools to the local Haitian community. I was okay with that, and I was very involved, even at a young age, involved in the litigation and understanding. Mm. And I think it gave me the tools to become who I am today. And it gave me a level of resiliency to be able to sidestep some of the adversities and keep going ahead. And it gave me those tools. Yeah, you know, I wanted to have a normal childhood sometimes. I wanted to go to a movie. But, you know, as you guys know, sacrificing to go out versus, you know, you have to get up and train the next day. So it was no different than your training schedule, but I never was able to leave it at the dojo. Mm. So that led me actually at segue to the question I have for you guys on, do you find yourselves to be more resilient because of judo in anything that comes your way?
I mean, I would say 100%. And Angie, you said it exactly earlier, the way I always used to think about it, now that things are harder in a different way. But I used to say, like, nothing is harder than judo. Nothing's harder than making weight. There's nothing harder than getting up and being in pain all over, like nails bent backwards, fingers sprained, feet cut open, thirsty, hungry, and still giving 110% so that you can be just that ounce a bit better at judo today than you were yesterday. And that, like, there, if you can do that, you can do anything. And that's very similar to what my coach here at San Jose State, Mr. Uchida, Yoshi Uchida, he, you know, 100 years old this year, still going on about judo because he just loves it. And that's his number one thing is, like, if you can take what's going to happen to you here in the dojo, these are literally his words, if you can take that, you can take anything in life. So I think that's exactly what it gives you. And that's what I wish, that it's so hard to tell someone that without them learning it themselves by getting on the mat. I wish there was some kind of, like, pill you could give people to make them understand that, so we could get more people doing judo.
That's so true. And, you know, Angie, I have a question for you. Well, first, you know, as we're coming to an end, I just want to remind you guys that our website is www.rustykanakogi.com. And it goes into her story, and the book, Get Up and Fight, can be purchased there. But Angie, I remember calling you when you were you awarded a small grant from the Rusty Kanakogi Fund? And I remember how excited you were. Can you describe when you got that phone call? First, you probably thought I was like some insurance salesperson or something. And after you realized it was me, how did you feel at that moment?
I mean, I think I received the grant prior to 2012. So I wasn't getting any money from anywhere else. I was kind of a starving athlete at that point. So it was definitely life-changing for me. If I didn't have, you know, support from other venues or support from USA Judo or support from the United States Olympic Committee, it was extremely hard to get the money to just go to tournaments, to be able to qualify for the Olympics. There's just so many factors that people don't know about when they think, like, oh, the Olympic Games. But there's so many steps you have to take in order to just qualify for an Olympic Games. So for me at that point, it was kind of, I think I took that money and I went to train. I competed and trained in Brazil, like, with that, I
went. Using it.
Yeah. So, I mean, it definitely made a huge change. And I think that was one of the first international tournaments that I competed at 52 kilograms. And that was kind of the beginning of my Olympic journey there.
That's amazing. And Marty, how, now that you're in the workforce, you've retired, how does your judo translate into your workplace?
Ooh, good question. I think the simplest thing is, like, your capacity to do a lot of work and, like, just sprint all the time, which isn't necessarily a good thing. I would say to Angie, maybe one piece of advice is, just because you can doesn't mean you should. but, like, that you definitely have a capacity to take on a lot of things. And I actually had someone I work with recently tell me, I think that you don't like to fail. Recently, and I was like, okay, like, no, but she's like, you always want to be killing it, and I was like, yeah, I am. That's kind of my personality, and I think it stems from being a judo player for sure. But nothing I would change other than just to set restrictions for yourself. You have to understand that about yourself when you enter the workforce, because you might be working for free if you're the type of person who's always going 110%, and, you know, you got to preserve your time in a good way.
And that's a segue for time. It looks like we're probably out of time. So I wanted to say thank you guys so much. It was really great getting to know both of you on another level. Angie, I wish you the best of luck in 2021. We'll be supporting you.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Yeah, Jean, it was great chatting with you as well. And I guess I wish you both a good 2021. Angie, we're going to be rooting for you all the way, girl.
Absolutely.
I actually have to get to practice in like 30 minutes.
That's it. That's what we want to hear.
Yes, keep going.
So,